Much was accomplished within 3 years. Cleanup days were one of the first activities of the organization, and members worked with their neighbors to remove trash. The Fight Back program awarded the Garfield neighborhood $80,000 worth of services, such as increasing police surveillance, obtaining better lighting in the streets, and maintaining public structures.
We are in an area where there is quite a bit of crime, and that you hear guns going off and you hear things happening, and along with that comes the fear. And of course you overcome the fear, and then you look at the positive things.
We show you a documentary about the positive results that can occur when people in a community decide to get together to improve their neighborhood. Right now on Alternative Views. In these days of doom and gloom, it's nice to hear a good story ever so often. That's what we're going to present to you on Alternative Views, a documentary by Jacqueline Paul about what some people in Phoenix did to improve their neighborhood.
This is a story about an inner city neighborhood that nobody cared about, and how an organization supplied leadership to help the residents help themselves. What is being learned in this process can be applied to any other community as long as people can get together, work together, and enjoy a sense of belonging.
But before we see our documentary, let's take a look at some news stories from the Alternative Press.
Once the 1988 presidential election was safely passed, the Republicans have had a surprise for voters. Taxpayers would have to pay for a multi-billion dollar SNL bailout. But in the months before the election, the Reagan-Bush administration reassured worriers that rumors of huge SNL losses were a myth. Well, the myth could end up costing taxpayers over $500 billion. This time around, though, history may have repeated itself in this past election. According to a November issue of Mother Jones, Stephen Pizzo says it's not the nation's SNLs, but the nation's banks that are on the brink of collapse. He says that even when President Bush hit the campaign trail, he knew that over 1,000 banks were on the Federal Reserve's so-called problem list. This is a list of banks that are in jeopardy of failing. Together, these shaky banks held over $611 billion in assets. But before this, so many banks had already failed during his administration that the deposit insurance fund was drained. In 1987, it had an $18.3 billion surplus. In 1991, a $7 billion deficit. Broke and with more banks sure to fail, the FDIC just recently went to Congress to borrow $70 billion. So if the banks are in such poor condition, why hasn't anyone heard of this? Pizzo thinks it's because the Bush administration, as it did with the SNL crisis, took extraordinary measures to hide it for the election. In December of 91, Bush summoned nearly 500 bank examiners to a meeting with top Treasury officials. The examiners were told that President Bush blamed them for the credit crunch behind the recession because they had been too tough on bankers. They were unnecessarily causing banks to fail. The scheme served to blunt enthusiasm for finding troubled banks and served as a scapegoat for an embarrassing election year recession. But many banks had become so unprofitable that even if bank examiners turned the other way, they still couldn't stay on their feet. So the administration turned to Federal Reserve Board Chairman Alan Greenspan, a Bush appointee, who obliged by slashing interest rates. They were cut to their lowest level in nearly three decades. These ultra-low interest rates served as a wonder drug for failing banks. Institutions that had just recently been about to fail were now recording record earnings. Of course, the cuts only created the illusion of profitability. The banks were still sick. They just looked healthy. Yet, when it comes to interest rates, what comes down must go back up. And when rates do go up again, these banks will be faced with the same problem that ruined the SNLs. Although Bush didn't win the election, he will eventually be handing the public a new multi-billion-dollar bill. How big will the bank tab be? Guesses begin at $70 billion and go up rapidly. If the SNL crisis is any guide, a similar bank collapse could easily cost over $600 billion. Add the interest borrowed to cover the losses, and that could translate into $1.8 trillion. Whatever the ultimate bill, it will be larger than it would have been had the Bush administration not covered up the crisis during the campaign.
An article in the Science News of July the 11th of 1992 says there's hints of a chlorine cancer connection. A new statistical analysis indicates that people who drink chlorinated water run a 21% greater chance of bladder cancer and a 38% greater risk of rectal cancer than people that drink water with little or no chlorine. So there's the beginning of speculation that chlorinated water might act as a carcinogen. Robert Morris, a doctor in the Medical College of the University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee, for instance, says, "I am quite convinced, based on this study, that there's an association between cancer and chlorinated water." So the water you drink may have all kinds of horrible things in there, which I guess is an argument for bottled water. You just got to make sure the bottled water you get doesn't have other impurities in it. There's been some exposés of some of the national brands of bottled water that are gotten from streams that provide the same source of water in the public water supplies, and therefore any different than the public water.
Well, there are some. I always shop at the health food stores and eat mainly all organic food, and I also drink distilled water, but I was looking at some of the special drinking water that they have there for sale. You look at the fine print, and one of them says it starts out with Houston Municipal Water Supply water. Then they do, you know, filter a little bit, and then you pay a premium for it. I looked at another brand that said San Antonio Municipal Water Supply.
That's the Artesia water.
Oh, God. But there is some hope. Organic baby food is a booming business. It seems that people now are becoming more and more concerned about what they put into their bodies. And so they're concerned now with what they put into their babies' bodies. And Earth Best is now the fourth largest baby food company in the country. And it uses no synthetic chemicals on crops that go into its 33-line item of food for babies. It's a five-year-old firm that buys produce only from growers who have been certified chemical-free for at least 3 years. And they add no salt, no sugar, and no fillers. Boy, if you want to see how good you can feel, just eat organic food for a while. And you taste, you say, hey, this is the way Grandma used to say food used to taste. But if you eat that stuff that's coming up from Mexico or third world countries, boy, beware, beware.
With the evidence mounting that we are losing the war on drugs, one group, however, appears to be winning. An article in the October issue of Utney Reader says that police departments are using materials seized in drug cases to supplement their budgets or spend it on high-tech equipment. They raise the question that police departments could be becoming addicted to drug money. The Federal Comprehensive Crime Control Act of 1984 made it easier for property to be seized if there's probable cause to believe it was used in connection with a crime. And this property can be seized even if no charges are ever filed. A Pittsburgh press report found that 8 out of 10 from whom property is taken are never even charged with a crime. But once property is taken, the owner must prove the allegations were false, often forcing them to hire an attorney and go to court. A USA Today report says that forfeitures have taken approximately $2.4 billion from people since its passage. Many suggest that the easy profits motivate police to investigate drug cases instead of violent crime. The Fort Lauderdale Sun-Sentinel recently investigated the Florida Contraband Forfeiture Act, which is one that is similar to the federal law, and found that this act is a key to a treasure chest in Florida. The enforcement agencies have used it to buy electron microscopes, helicopters, night vision goggles, things that the taxpayers never would have okayed if they had to foot the bill. All efforts to modify the bill so that 25% of the money goes to drug education and rehabilitation have been stopped by lobbying from police groups. How far will the police go to get this money? One sergeant in the Florida investigation has seized over $2 million, including $343,000 in just one day. So what about our civil liberties? Recent polls say that 51% of Americans are willing to give up their rights guaranteed under the Constitution in order to wage an effective war on drugs. And property forfeiture may increase if the new bill called the Federal Omnibus Crime Bill is passed. This new law would criminalize political opposition in such vague terms that human rights, environmental, and union activities could be criminalized. Provisions being considered include seizure of property of political activists based on the drug model law.
Progressive magazine for November of 1992 has a critique of a ABC live program on welfare fraud. They say it was just a sensationalistic piece of reporting which doesn't have much to do with reality. But the pitiful part about it is that there is little substantiation for the sensationalist claims that it makes, saying that, you know, all these welfare cheats are rampant, and of course it's costing you and I, the taxpayers, all this money. Now, if it really is easy to commit such fraud, as the show made it seem, according to the Progressive, it would have been very easy for Primetime Live, the ABC people, to have some people trying to masquerade as welfare recipients and go in and walk out with a check and just perpetrate the fraud right there. But the truth is, it isn't so easy. During the Reagan era, all these bloated bureaucracies were set up to make sure that people didn't get slipped by, the people that weren't supposed to. And it's also very much more difficult in the time of economic crisis for people. They're making it tougher for people to get welfare. It reached such a silly way in the crackdown, supposedly crackdown on welfare cheats, that Los Angeles spent almost $2.5 million in a fingerprinting system to detect welfare cheats back in 1991. And how many do you think they caught? As many. 11. So regardless of the facts, the anecdotes about lazy welfare recipient taking handouts and draining on the economy just aren't true. They're made to be scapegoats, and even Bill Clinton says that poor people need to take more personal responsibility for themselves, and says he's going to have a 2-year limit on welfare. Kick them out after they're through. Now, Primetime Live, did they show some of the people who are getting all this welfare for the rich? No, but they did show a group of tobacco farmers as being poor, beleaguered workers complaining about all these welfare cheats. But, well, ABC didn't tell you that tobacco farming is the most subsidized industry in America. Now, there are some people who do commit some cheating on welfare, particularly because if you go to work, then the money that you get is deducted from your welfare. Or if you are on workfare and get out of the welfare system, you may be making a little bit more money than you would on welfare, but you're no longer covered by medical care if you're not under welfare. So people may be making just a little bit more money, but they can't afford to get off of the hospitalization and medical care. So they just won't tell the welfare people that they're that they are working on the side. Well, this isn't much of a problem with the people. It is with the system, where the people can't make a decent wage and they're not covered by for hospital care. So The welfare system is a mess, according to Progressive, because it entices people with so much money up for grabs. It's not because of that, but it's because the system does not help people get out of poverty, and it penalizes those people who do go to work. So this wretched ABC section on welfare cheats was nothing but that, just cheap sensationalism.
I just wonder what the absolute costs of welfare fraud might be. A few million dollars a year? Maybe a few hundred million even? Probably not, but let's compare that to the $500 billion being paid in welfare to all the people who were involved in the SNLs, all the greedy investors and the greedy lawyers and the greedy bank directors, SNL directors. Sounds like welfare to me, too, but again, if you're big enough, then it's fine. Let, you know, if you steal $100, you're in trouble. If you steal $1 million, you're a hero, pillar of the community.
And I've never, you never see the networks going after welfare for the rich, all the subsidies for the agriculture conglomerates, agribusiness, for the tobacco industry, for the timber industry, and the tax breaks that the wealthy get. You don't see that. They go after these poor, miserable people who are poor and trying to just stay alive.
Actually, in the November Harpers, they also reported that really you could let a free market solution take a free market approach to protecting the woodlands in the Northwest, because it's so expensive, actually, to go in there and cut down that old growth forest that they couldn't do it if they weren't getting federally subsidized land to do it on. If they had to pay market value for that land and for those trees, there's just no way there'd be a logging industry. So the whole time they're whining about being freed up to do their thing, to perform their commerce, they're getting federal handouts the whole time.
Let's turn now to an award-winning documentary by Jacqueline Paul about what some of the people in a neighborhood in Phoenix have done to help themselves.
This is a story about an inner-city neighborhood that nobody cared about, and how an organization supplied leadership to help the residents help themselves. What is being learned in this process can be applied to any other community, as long as people can get together, work together, and enjoy a sense of belonging. Welcome to Garfield, a neighborhood in Phoenix, Arizona. 440 acres of old homes, vacant lots, and poverty. It is also a place of renovation and change, of hope mingled with despair, of people concerned about their neighborhood and wanting to preserve its flavor. The last 20 years has seen great changes in the living conditions and in the people who live here. Hundreds of homes were torn down in order to build a freeway. And although there are more than 2,000 families in the neighborhood, homeowners are being replaced by renters. The population, primarily Hispanic, increases every year with the influx of immigrants from across the border. Like most inner city areas, there is also growing crime and the accompanying fear and mistrust among the various ethnic and age groups. This, too, is changing, thanks to some people who were encouraged to get together and try to save their neighborhood. Early in 1989, A young couple from Chile came to Phoenix to work with the Institute of Cultural Affairs, a nonprofit organization that believes neighborhoods like Garfield can be changed for the better if the residents become motivated to get together and learn through experience how to improve their situation. Raul Huquera and his wife, Angelica Rodriguez, were assigned by ICA to work with the Garfield neighborhood from the ground up, using the beliefs, training, and experience they had gained as staff for ICA in Chile, Peru, Brazil, and Venezuela. Within a short time, they began going from door to door, getting to know the many kinds of people who lived there, finding out what they were most concerned about in the area. Within a few months, they had visited more than 150 families, discussing the issues of the neighborhood, and had placed announcements in the local newspapers about forming a group of concerned residents that would meet together and get started on improving the neighborhood. Two planning events were held, which resulted in forming the Garfield Organization, a neighborhood alliance, in April 1989. A board was selected, made up of residents, and Lupe Cisneros, a resident who had lived in Garfield 18 years, was elected president.
I'm really working hard to see that maybe we can make this neighborhood into a neighborhood where we can all live like one family, help each other, and care about each other. And I think that if we can accomplish that, I think we will have accomplished something that may not have ever happened if Garfield Neighborhood Organization didn't exist.
Today, the Garfield Organization has obtained nonprofit status and has more than 200 members working in many ways to create a better community. Once a month, an open meeting is held in the local elementary school. Attendance varies, but what is important is that people are encouraged to contribute their ideas about what needs to be done and what kinds of projects in cooperation with local city officials and agencies can help them accomplish their goals. Getting to know one's neighbors has been a priority, so a monthly newsletter and leaflets containing information about the organization were printed in both English and Spanish and passed out by the members to their neighbors. As a result of community planning, committees were formed to work on a variety of issues and events, contacting city officials and other agencies about their needs. Forming partnerships and obtaining sponsors for events was of primary importance, as this work led to Garfield receiving attention and recognition for the first time in its history.
It is working. The reason I say it's working is because we're here, and we've got committees. When I started coming to this organization, I was getting very frustrated as to what was going on, because I was doing a lot of work in my community, in my block area, and I wasn't seeing results. But now that we got committees, and we got coordinators coordinating those committees, and having regular meetings, we can see the results.
Much was accomplished within 3 years. Cleanup days were one of the first activities of the organization, and members worked with their neighbors to remove trash. This effort resulted in a closer working relationship with the city maintenance department, which now has a special trash pickup 4 times a year. After only a year, the first health fair was held in the school cafeteria, which drew over 500 people. Many agencies partnered with the Garfield Organization to educate the residents about their health and give them important information about the kinds of services available for them in the Phoenix area. This was especially important for the Hispanic families that attended and who couldn't speak English. They appreciated the help from the Garfield Organization members who translated for them. This kind of activity, as well as festivals, visits from local officials and celebrities, and the sponsorship of a local corporation which made it possible for three houses in the neighborhood to be painted, brought attention from the media. By the third year, Garfield had created new partnerships, the Fight Back program of the City of Phoenix and Christmas in April, a national program dedicated to helping low-income homeowners refurbish their homes. The Garfield neighborhood was chosen to have work done on 20 houses within one day's time, and members of the organization spent months in interviewing residents and determining what houses would be repaired and painted on that day. The Fight Back program awarded the Garfield neighborhood $80,000 worth of services, such as increasing police surveillance, obtaining better lighting in the streets, and maintaining public structures. A ceremony to honor this partnership was held on February 1992, and many people participated. Although the Fight Back Assistance is just a 13-week program, it illustrates that the Garfield neighborhood is beginning to get needed attention from the city.
I'd like to welcome all of you and introduce you to two friends that I met just today. Friend number one is Rosendo. Friend number two is Anna. And isn't really this the reason that we're here? For the kids, for a decent place to grow up, and for a decent community to live. That's what this partnership is all about. I appreciate your support. We'll be in your neighborhoods for the next 3 months. We'll be seen often. We'll do what we can. Help us help you.
These changes didn't happen overnight, and probably might not have taken place at all if it hadn't been for the guidance of Raul and Angelica and the principles they were applying from the Institute of Cultural Affairs. Marilyn Nugent was a very active board member from the beginning. She participated in several workshops and facilitator training sessions held by ICA for members of the community, and she acknowledges how this experience changed her life.
It changed the way I viewed working in the neighborhood. It changed what I thought the neighborhood organization should be. It no longer was a high priority for me that the neighborhood organization function like a homeowners association. Rather, I became aware of how incredibly important it is to have discussion and consensus by people, everybody we could get in the neighborhood, and to use the techniques that they offered, because it allows everyone to contribute. One thing I'd really like to point out that I have learned, and many of us have learned, from Raul and Angelica. They use projects in the neighborhood, whether it's cleanup or graffiti, paint out or whatever, to get people working together. We were oriented toward the task, you know, getting the graffiti wiped out, getting the alleys cleaned up. And the tendency was for one or two people to organize it and do it. They have brought an awareness level to us that really the important thing is not how well you get that task done, but the working together, the process.
Problems still exist, but if we listen to the people who have been taking an active role wherever and whenever they can in the neighborhood, it is possible to get a fairly accurate picture of the community as it functions today and what still needs to be done. Doug Fox, a retired homeowner, has lived here for 5 years and finds a central location close to the city an advantage and the neighborhood friendly. However, he is aware that his section of the neighborhood does not represent the majority of the residents.
The area that I live into, quite frankly, is one of the nicer areas and has some of the nicer old homes. Other areas are not privileged to have as the homes are older, they're run down more, the neighborhoods are more rentals. There are more homeowners here, as an example. I like to have the meetings that we go to. I would like to see them better represented. The more people I think we have out, the better we can cover what the whole neighborhood problems might be.
The Garfield neighborhood is 65% Hispanic, yet there is much less representation in the organization. One of the active Hispanic members is Senora Arroz. She is a homeowner and has lived here 35 years. She remembers better days, but does not want to move.
Oh, everything was beautiful. Everybody had beautiful lawns and flowers, and everything was, people were younger. You know, 35 years ago make a lot of difference. I like the neighborhood here. Yes, you go down like that and ask the people, they tell you they like the neighborhood. We've been here for so long that I don't mind walking around here or anything, but they say it's dangerous. It's dangerous every place.
Next door to Senora Arroz lives her granddaughter, who, with her sister, recently purchased the house. For her, the present has hope.
I've been here for 23 years, and my family has been here for over 50, 60 years. And the way I feel about the neighborhood is I feel like it has some really good potential. As long as people, everyone, neighbors, everyone, just takes an active role in preserving the neighborhood. And I think it can happen.
Mr. Daniel Pena is sympathetic to the new immigrants and is involved with one of Garfield's partnerships, the Neighborhood Housing Service, to provide the opportunity for these people to purchase homes.
Many new houses are going to be built in this neighborhood, and there are many, many Spanish-speaking folks that qualify to have a new house under the low-income program. But we're going to have to work on a program to translate to them when these meetings are come about, explaining how this program works.
The people in my neighborhood are, they're homeowners and they're elderly, in which they cannot always get out to these meetings. Not that they they approve of what we are doing, but they can't always participate. They want to stay in this area. They do not want to be forced out by gangs, drugs, and et cetera. So they are very much enthused about trying to keep it or to fix it up.
Arlene Muir has been an active board member of the Garfield organization from the beginning and is always ready to visit with friends, such as Gloria and Dave Hayes, to discuss the latest project of concern and share ideas with Angelica. Their home is in one of the older areas.
And it was the love of these older homes that brought us here, and plus the fact that we couldn't afford to live in a more expensive neighborhood with older homes, so we found ourselves here. And I have to admit, it was a different culture, a different type of life than we'd ever lived in before. And it's been really interesting living here and getting to know how different people interact. And this neighborhood has so many different nationalities in it. And it's just been so interesting to just see how different people are, and yet they're really all alike. And when you get to know them, they're really all alike. So this has been a lot of fun and a lot of heartache, too. A lot of things have been hard to get used to here because we are in an area where there is quite a bit of crime, and that you hear guns going off and you hear things happening. And along with that comes the fear. And, of course, you overcome the fear, and then you look at the positive things. But there has been a lot of good things, and I want to stress the good things. There's been a lot of growth in me personally, I'll say that, because I look at people a whole lot differently than I used to. I guess I kind of used to look at people by what they had or what kind of cars they drove, and now I think I'm beginning to look at people in a totally different light, because here, you don't have any of that. Nobody's impressing nobody down here. So that's real, real good.
Gloria's neighbor, Armando, does not share her positive attitude and wants to leave.
Well, the reason why I'm moving is that I'm very happy with my house. I work on it, and I'm very happy with my wife and my two kids. The reason why I'm moving out is because the neighborhood is too dirty. And I don't know, it shouldn't bother me because my house is clean, but still, I just can't live this way. So there's a person that he is buying my house, and I think the deal is going on, and I think I just can't come back.
Right.
Yeah.
Mr. and Mrs. Grisby, both active in the Garfield organization, have no intention of moving. They have lived here since 1956 and are retired school teachers.
The conditions in the neighborhood have deteriorated, in part, I think, because there are people that we cannot communicate with. I think it's the change of the mix of people.
The biggest change has been in the freeway. There were houses along Culver and Moreland. And when that freeway was built and the houses were torn down, it changed the nature of this neighborhood altogether.
Because lots of houses were torn out, and only those that could not be sold or the people did not want to sell were left.
Most of those who remained left their houses and rented them out, and they moved elsewhere.
The existing buildings that you see were here originally. So they were here before we got here, which means they're probably 50 years or more old. And little has been done to them since the first renters or owners moved out.
Garfield has been able to get a number of houses and places demolished. We've had the ear of our councilman, Calvin Good, and the planning department of the city is working with us, but some of these things move very slowly.
Because Mr. Good represents the Garfield neighborhood, he attends many of the functions held each year. The Chili Pachanga Festival, held at Alwyn House, a community arts center in Garfield, is a favorite place for people from all walks of life to meet and get to know more about the area. Kim Moody, the director of the center, has been here 20 years and is an active member of the Garfield organization.
I see that our efforts of redevelopment and the efforts of the city coordinated with the efforts of the neighborhood I've been watching that trend grow for a long time. That is the development of the neighborhood, neighborhood interests over any other interest. Chili Pachanga was an excellent example of where we brought these elements together, where we brought in the politicians, the ones specifically dealing with crime and the fight back funding, congressmen, the council persons that are very much involved with the strengthening of the downtown through a variety of programs.
Ollie's activities have involved more than 1,000 residents from the Garfield neighborhood and other neighborhoods in Phoenix within a very short time. And this will increase as long as the energy and commitment is there. The city recognizes such dedication, and in its contest, Neighborhoods at Work gave awards to the Garfield organization for excellence, partnership, environment, and politics.
Today, after last year, which at the end of my speech, I didn't have words enough to say except that I thought we did as well as having gotten an Academy Award. We have just continued to work, and we have accomplished so many things in this last year. We just finished finished our Christmas and April program, which included renovating 26 houses for the elderly and the needy. It was a great, great success, and we just continue to work, I'm sure. And we need to thank ICA very much for all the help and all the time and the efforts that they have contributed. If it weren't for them, I don't think we would have made it this far. Thank you.
The Garfield organization, now that it's approximately 3 years old, is at a real turning point. We have the basis where we could really move forward and make life in this neighborhood for everybody much better. Or we could our energies could be too unfocused, and we could lose it. I think we need to focus on certain things right now, and if we do, I think that Garfield organization and the neighborhood will see, it'll probably take 10 years, 20 years, but I think we will see this neighborhood becoming one of the really neat neighborhoods in the city. Unique, not a suburban neighborhood. I think it will accommodate, I hope it will accommodate all kinds of people and have retain its flavor, its diverseness and vitality. I'd like to see the vitality improve even more.
Dios a él para que todos nosotros estemos juntos, peleemos juntos, lloremos juntos. It means for all of us to fight together, be together, and cry together.
May we celebrate and enjoy our cultural diversity.
And I just love it. I love that we're beginning to care about one another. And I'm toasting to caring about one another.
Yeah. Yeah.
Para un barrio limpio, seguro y ordenado.
We turn now from the ecology of a neighborhood to the ecology of the earth. In a recent program, Kirkpatrick Sale, author of Conquest of Paradise, discussed the effect of Columbus' legacy on Native Americans. Now he'll discuss the ecological legacy of Columbus in this hemisphere.
Well, we are today a country living out this Columbian legacy. And we find that in the study of it, we see that this European culture of 1492 came across the ocean with Columbus and found this bountiful soil to grow in, and that's who we are. 1992, we are living out the values and the ideas of 1492, except that we are doing it rather more efficiently and powerfully, because we have learned the techniques of greater and greater destruction and manipulation and exploitation. Well, this business of subduing nature is something that we've turned out that we're very, very good at, except that if we win that war, ultimately we lose that war.
Frank, let's talk about this ecological crisis. As we're taping this interview, President Bush is going around talking about Mr. Ozone, a reference to the vice presidential candidate, Al Gore, who had the temerity to write a book on ecology. So Bush's attitude is that it's just crazy to be worried about ecological crisis and the ozone layer and things like this. What does this tell you about the attitude of, say, the American power structure, that the elite, that the president could actually have such an aggressive anti-ecological attitude or mentality, and that obviously he's doing this for campaign reasons, to try to mobilize his constituency who somehow are against quote-unquote environmental extremists? Right. I mean, isn't this disturbing?
He thinks they are. I don't know what he's doing. He has said that he will do anything to get elected. And presumably this is part of it. I mean, it doesn't make any sense, and he knows better than that, but he thinks that if he says he cares about jobs and Mr. Ozone cares about the environment, and people will buy this as being in their short-term interest to care about jobs and not the world in which those jobs are located. I'm not sure that people will fall for that kind of idiocy, but it does say something about him and his administration and the Reagan administration that he follows and corporate America's idea of environmentalism, which is this extra added nuisance that raises the prices of things and costs jobs. Just because there's a bunch of liberals who are, care about these silly things like clean air and clear water and survival on the face of the earth. It does seem surprising that we could have a political and economic system whose leaders believe things like that. But it's true. And even your Al Gore in this book, though it is a book that has some merit to it, falls very far short when it comes to practical measures as to what it is that he wants to do. He doesn't provide us with any real solutions. He does say that it is the industrial civilization that's the problem, the same way I would say it, and that this Columbian legacy he understands is the problem. He does say that there has to be a spiritual relationship with nature. For him, it's a fundamentalist, but at any rate, spiritual relationship to nature. And I would again agree with him. And then he goes on to say that, well, we have to pass laws and regulations and have more bureaucracy and do all the same stuff that we've been doing for 30 years now and hasn't done almost any good at all. But he wants us to do more of that same thing. He too, therefore, and Clinton along with him, limited in their perceptions of how serious the problem is and where it is that we have to go in order to find solutions.
Well, how serious is it, and then what will the solution be?
Well, it is stuff that people read every day in the newspapers, and every day we, in fact, find new evidence of things that are going wrong. I don't think there's any doubt in the American public that there is an environmental crisis. We might like to say that the jobs are more important than it, but we would say that about anything. We would say that it's better to protect the jobs of these Nazi extermination camp guards because they're jobs, without thinking about what it is that they're doing. But anyway, the daily newspapers provide evidence of a
series of crises that altogether mount up to one catastrophe. And there's nobody who seriously looks at this stuff, I think, who does not feel that it has the potential of destroying not merely the human animal, but the biosphere, the living biosphere that we all depend upon. I was at this conference in Morelia a year ago where worldwide scientists and ecologists and activists came together to issue a statement to the world that the crisis is much worse than we are acting. We say, all right, these crises here, but we're not acting to do anything about it. And these scientists who study this stuff said to the gathering there that we have a generation, or maybe two generations, to turn this around, to do something about it, to get us out of these accumulating crises. Two generations at most. Mm-hmm. Well, we're not doing it. We're not acting that way at all. We are passing piddling little laws and all of those with great resistance from the political and economic establishment, which don't want to change anything at all. The crisis is so obvious that I think that we really don't want to talk about it, because in order to find our way out of the crisis, we would have to give up being and doing what we are today. We live as Americans using up 40% of the world's resources every single year for 5% of the fire, less than 5% of the world's population. We live at the level beyond kings of the past. Nobody could possibly have imagined in 1492 that anyone could have such power as individuals, Americans, have, where at the flick of a switch or the turn of a key, we have the equivalent of 800, maybe 1,000 servants working for us. Well, so, naturally we don't want to give this up. Naturally we want to continue it. And we don't want to think about the fact that in order to live at this level, we are using up the species and the ecosystems of the Earth at an alarming rate that is not sustainable, that will kill us in all of our glory within two generations.
You know, what I think is so pitiful is that it's okay. I mean, if Homo sapiens vanishes from the Earth, that'd probably be a good thing for the Earth. But the fact that they could also destroy the Earth as a living thing and make it into a Venus where no life can be sustained, that to me is the ultimate.
Well, may not be that bad. I think probably all we are capable of doing is destroying life on the surface of the Earth. And it does seem a shame that if we go down, we're going to take down all the oxygen-dependent species and life on the surface as we know it. But below the waters, life will continue. I think that the Earth, the living Earth, been living these 4.5 billion years, will stay alive, and it will not become a Venus. There will still be life below the surface, and that slowly and gradually, probably the Earth will work to create new life forms, because I think that's what makes the Earth survive in the bountiful, wonderful way that it has, is such life forms as the trees that nature evolved, the plant forms. The animal forms are practically insignificant, most of them. The coral reefs are important, but the animal forms are not so important. So I think that you could imagine a living Earth regenerating plant forms and trees in some future time, and a wise and careful kind of living Earth, I think, would be careful not to make the mistake of the large bipedal mammalian species known as the human.
What sorts of things need to be done to prevent the worst consequences of environmental crisis?
It's very simple. We simply have to give up the values of Western civilization.
That's all.
Oh, well,
all right, I agree.
You ask for a solution, there's a solution. I mean, and actually, This is not so incomprehensible. If we can see that those values, as they come transmitted to us by Columbus, are leading us in a path of ever greater destruction, as I think we inevitably can, and that the pathways of materialism and violence and exploitation and despoliation of nature are not really the ways we want to go, we can say, well, this Western civilization was all right for its time, but we need to replace it with an ecological society. And what will that ecological society look like? And fortunately, we know what it will look like, because for most of humans' time on Earth, they have lived in an ecological society, or they haven't survived. And we know it among the tribal peoples that we see around the Earth everywhere. Particularly for us as North Americans, we see it in the American Indian societies. And I speak here of the tribal societies, not the hierarchical state societies of the Aztecs and the Incas, which were as bad in their empires as any empire was and will be. Empires are not the salvation of the Earth, including the American Empire. But these tribal societies do offer us a way of seeing an alternative set of values that could lead us into that ecological society away from the values of the Western civilization that is leading us into doomsday. And we see in them quite simple ways of regarding the Earth as holy, as sacred, as something that we are a part of, that there's a web of life, and that it's all holy, all sacred, and that the human is just one of the species, that it's not different from any of the others except in its ability to blush, mm-hmm. and its need to blush. and if we understand the world in a biocentric rather than an anthropocentric way, then we will begin to understand a way that we can live upon the Earth carefully, reverentially, spiritually. We will begin to understand the laws of nature. And the laws of nature are all out there for us to follow. And they have been there always. I mean, everything is connected. You can't do one thing. There is no away. Small is beautiful. Mother knows best. Mother Earth knows best. I mean, those simple laws of nature have always been there, and tribal societies have always known them and always tried to live within them. And there are people who understand this now. There are representatives of those tribal societies who have worked hard to learn the traditions of the Indian past, and they're out there. There are Indians there all around us who realize that their salvation kind of depends upon our learning this wisdom. And they're willing to teach us this stuff. Our opportunity now is to seek them out wherever they are and to listen and to try then. Then we understand the values, at any rate, that this ecological society is going to have to work toward. After that, it seems to me we each develop in our own place the kind of institutions and systems that we want to live out those values. And I think it'll look very different in different parts of this country, in different parts of the world. But I have confidence that as soon as we have the right values, that those institutions will all work themselves out. But the problem is, of course, getting away from the set of values that we have clung to for the last 500 years and learning a new set of values.
And that's the end of this Alternative Views. Frequently hear from viewers who request a list of news publications which we use on Alternative Views, and also a reading list for U.S. power structure in the mass media. If you would like to have these, send a stamped, self-addressed envelope to the Alternative Information Network, P.O. Box 7279, Austin, Texas, 78713. You must send a self-addressed stamped envelope. That's also our mailing address if you'd like to write to us. Goodbye.